Enfield, Illinois. Barely a mile across, this tiny village finds itself perpetually caught between two worlds. Forever surrounded by vast expanses of agricultural fields and working farms, as well as the simple beauty of Mother Nature. Its quintessential small-town charm and modesty is reminiscent of so many of the tight-knit communities across the rural Midwest. It is the perfect retreat from the hustle and bustle of the big city. This tranquil setting is a reminder of the timeless appeal of a quieter, simpler life. However, for the 780 citizens that called Enfield, Illinois home in 1973, that was about to change. For their small, tiny village was about to be visited by something truly monstrous. History is rife with tales of the inexplicable and the unknown. Stories so bizarre, they send the fingers of doubt creeping into the recesses of our very minds. Join us as we investigate.
This week in Creepy History.
I'm Laura Cram, and welcome to Season 1, Episode 10 of the Creepy Acres Podcast, This Week in Creepy History. And with me, as always, is my very funny Bigfoot co-host, Sam Squatch.
Hey, how you doing, Laura?
Are you okay over there?
No, I'm fine. I'm just trying to figure out how the hell we're at 10. 10?
I know.
I'm going to tell you right now.
Okay.
We're 10 episodes in.
I know.
It feels like a billion. How is it only 10?
It's shocking.
Look, not that this is a chore to talk to you every goddamn month. Right. But I will tell you, I really, really felt like it was a lot more than 10.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Like a lot more.
Yes.
I mean, because we talked to a lot of people.
We have. And there's more to come.
Is there? Oh, God. How many more?
A lot.
I did not know that when I signed up for this gig.
We have some fantastic guests coming up. I cannot wait.
Is Lorenzo Lamas one of them?
Who?
Lorenzo Lamas, star of the show Renegade. Have you not heard of this guy?
That's like an older show, right?
Yeah, it is older. But look, the reason I'm bringing it up is because back in the 90s, he had the show called Renegade, right? And it was a big deal. It was a huge deal. Okay.
Okay.
But if you go on Facebook right now,
yes,
we have twice as many fans as Lorenzo Lamas Renegade. And I was hoping he'd be a guest. So I'd be like, suck it, Lorenzo Lamas. But granted. Now understand. This is only Lorenzo Lamas Renegade. Lorenzo Lamas, the actor, has like 200, almost 300,000 followers, which we don't even come close to.
We'll get there.
But Lorenzo Lamas Renegade, he can eat our shit. That's
Whoa.
What I'm saying. He's so beneath me. Oh, I love the power. It feels good. All right.
Sam, how are you?
I'm great. Did you not just hear what I said about how Lorenzo Lamas is like eating our dust? Only on Facebook. Not Lorenzo Lamas the actor, but Lorenzo Lamas Renegade. That's what I'm pointing at. Okay.
I did hear that. So.
Yes, Laura.
Episode 10. We are talking about a case that happened in Illinois, which is actually the state that I live in.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. I thought when you talk about the state you live in, I thought you were going to say state of despair, but go on.
Well, Samuel.
Yes, Laura.
Now, I know Illinois has lots of cases.
Yes.
And we've already have two episodes of things that happened in Illinois. We have the first episode.
Yes.
Which was?
Murfreesboro Mud Monster. Murph.
Yes.
My buddy, Murph. Yeah.
With Chad Lewis.
Yes. I love Chad Lewis. He's the best.
He's so wholesome.
Yes, he is.
Yes. And then our episode 2 with Troy Taylor, we talked about, do you remember?
There was the Lawndale Thunderbird attack. Available episode 2. Go check it out. Honest to God. Get those numbers up, folks. What are you doing? All right. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, and know what? Please leave us a review on Spotify or Apple or wherever you listen. Give us the 5 stars if you can.
Yeah.
We really appreciate it.
And of course, if you're listening, you don't like what you hear, just walk away. Just walk away, man.
Okay.
Don't be a hero. Tough guy. All right. Okay. All right.
Okay. Let's full circle here. Go back to Illinois.
Yes.
So today's episode happened in the 70s, 1970s, and the creature that was seen had 3 legs and 2 itty-bitty, like, T-Rex arms.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know what the hell that is. That
okay,
is,
I don't know either.
Bleh. Three legs.
Yep.
Two little T-Rex arms.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. Useless T-Rex arms.
Ugh. Blech.
Ugh.
I'm just picturing this little flaccid,
blech,
flappy arm. Ew. Just blech, 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 blech,
blech, ew.
Just ew. But look, those of you of a certain age may remember Modulok from He-Man. That's what I'm picturing. But with, like, little flaccid, limp, like, little sloppy
ew
arms. Just, blech. Yuck.
All right. I'm done talking about this. Let's just hand it over to Nathaniel Leonards, and he can tell us all about this icky monster.
Yeah. Flappy arms. Blah, 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 blah.
Gross.
Louisville and Nashville Railroad, commonly known as the L&N Railroad, chartered by the Commonwealth of Kentucky in 1850. This railway would grow into one of the greatest success stories in all of American history. It would operate for 132 years, surviving the American Civil War, 2 World Wars, and the stock market crash of 1929. As well as the Great Depression that followed. In fact, it would operate so consistently, it would even gain the nickname Old Reliable. And soon, it would serve 14 states, and its 5,223.4 miles of railway track would connect cities like St. Louis, Cincinnati, Nashville, Memphis, Atlanta, and even New Orleans. Vast network of steel and iron that stretched across the southeastern United States like a spider web of prosperity and opportunity. For anywhere it touched, new towns would take root and grow. Towns like Enfield, Illinois. Founded in 1868, this sleepy little village rests in White County, located in the southeastern portion of the state. At its height, in 1900, Enfield boasted a population of 971 citizens. It was home to 3 general stores, 4 grocery stores, 4 churches, 5 physicians, hardware store, livery stable, and even a dentist. In fact, Enfield, Illinois would also have not just one, but several newspapers, including the Enfield Republican and the Enfield Express. For just a moment, it appeared as if Enfield, Illinois might grow into something truly remarkable. And then, like so many promising towns before it, it simply wasn't meant to be. And by the 2010 census, the little village that had held so much promise and potential just 110 years prior had now dwindled to less than 600 souls. The numerous storefronts and medical practices had simply faded away. And in the spring of 1933, much of the downtown area would be consumed by fire. Even the newspapers, once with wide circulation, were now gone. But one thing remained. The L and N Railway. Old, reliable. Its tracks that had once brought so much promise and opportunity to Enfield still stood cutting their diagonal path across the western part of the village before leveling out just south of Enfield, where they would continue their journey east. And there, on the west side of town, just a few feet from those tracks, sat a tiny little nondescript house. A simple, one-story home that was about to become the epicenter of one of the most bizarre and inexplicable stories to ever come out of the Prairie State. For those very railroad tracks that were once thought to have been a pathway to promise and prosperity were now thought to have led something else to Enfield, Illinois. Something inhuman. April 25th, 1973. It is 9:30 p.m. when 50-year-old antiques dealer Henry McDaniel returns home with his wife, Lillian, age 36, following a meeting earlier that night. What begins as just another routine Wednesday night is about to decay into utter madness. For when the couple open the front door of their small home, what they find waiting for them shakes them to their very core. Huddled there in the center of the room, crying and clinging to one another, are their children. Henry McDaniel Jr., their son, and Lillian, their daughter, who the family simply calls Lil. The children, now finally safe in the presence of their mother and father, begin to recount the terror that had transpired in their absence. For earlier that night, while the two sat home alone, they began to hear a sound, a scratching at the door. Thinking it was perhaps a stray kitten or maybe a neighbor's dog, the children opened that door without a second thought in the world. It was a decision they would regret for the rest of their lives, for when they opened it, they found themselves face to face with a nightmare. With but the briefest glimpse of the twisted abomination that stood there before them, the children slammed the door and locked it. Their minds now reeling, Henry Jr. and Lil stood frozen in silent terror. The shock of what they had just seen was still washing over them, but they took some comfort in believing they were safe behind that heavy wooden door. And then they heard it again. A scratching. But this time, it was not from the door. Instead, it was coming from the side of the house. Whatever it was moving about outside their home. And then came a new sound. Suddenly, they realized that the noise they were hearing was the sound of the misshapen creature they had seen only moments before, now ripping at the back of an air conditioning unit that had been installed in a nearby window. Their monster was trying to get in. Fear seized the McDaniel children, for they knew that with one simple decent push, that the machine wedged into that window would simply give way and fall into the house. And with that, the hideous thing they had seen so briefly would and could easily spring through that opening. Terrified, the McDaniel children sat motionless, helpless, powerless, waiting and praying. Those prayers would be answered with the arrival of their parents at home. This was the story Lil and her brother Henry Jr. would tell their mother and father. The McDaniels were clearly concerned, but undoubtedly skeptical. While it was obvious their son and daughter had seen something, they simply couldn't grasp the bizarre and bewildering monstrosity their children had described to them. Instead, they chose to believe it was far more likely to be a sick or wounded animal that had made its way to the door of the family's home. And while caught in the grip of fear, Henry Jr. and Lil's imagination had twisted the scene into something otherworldly. The McDaniels would simply dismiss the entire series of events as the overactive imaginations of their children, and nothing more. That is, they would have, if not for what happened next. For suddenly, the McDaniels heard it. The sound. The sound of something scratching at that very door. Henry McDaniel would turn and walk toward the noise, and with every step he took across that tiny house, the sound only grew louder. He would glance out the window and spot something outside. And whatever it was alive, and it was big. In fact, it was so big that McDaniel thought it might be a bear. The area around Enfield, Illinois, was so scarcely populated that it would not be impossible. Fearing that that was what now stood at the door of his home, McDaniel sprinted across the small one-story house to his and his wife's bedroom. There, from his nightstand, he retrieved a pistol and a flashlight. He would race back to the door and throw it open, where he would be greeted by only the wind and darkness. With no other choice, Henry McDaniel would step out into that breezy night, unsure of what it was he might find. But it wouldn't leave him waiting long. There, in the darkness, next to the huge maple tree that grew in his front yard, between two rose bushes, stood a bizarre and misshapen thing. For there, in the gloom, Henry could make out a figure that was 4 to 5 feet tall, covered in a gray fur, with a short body and a large, wide head. He was standing a mere 8 feet away when he illuminated the creature with his flashlight. And suddenly, the description his children had gave him of the creature they had seen at the door all came flooding back. And to his horror, it all made perfect sense. For what he saw before him was no bear. In fact, it bared almost no resemblance to anything he had ever seen in his life.
I shined my flashlight on it and saw these two eyes about 3 inches apart, kind of glowing red or pink back at me like truck reflectors. And it had 3 legs right in a row, standing there just like a man. Its arms were short and stubby.
In one hand, the man held a flashlight, in the other, a gun. A gun he knew how to use. For Henry McDaniel wasn't just an antique dealer. He was also a disabled World War II vet. His training as a soldier took over, and he wasted no time, and in an instant pointed that weapon and fired. Four times, Henry McDaniel pulled the trigger of his .22 Magnum at nearly point-blank range. A trained soldier. Only for it to have seemingly no effect. The creature simply hissed, much like a wildcat, and then bounded away toward the nearby railroad tracks.
Did you ever hear a cottonmouth hiss? Well, that's how it sounded. And then it jumped into those weeds over there, and then it jumped again over that ditch, and then a third time onto the tracks. I never did see it turn, it just jumped.
And in a mere 3 leaps, the three-legged monstrosity traveled 75 feet, and just like that, it was gone. The McDaniels family, now terrified, would alert the authorities, and soon, the Illinois State Police would arrive. Henry McDaniels and the officers would search the area, while their investigation would discover no monster, the men would find something else. There, pressed into the soft earth, were bizarre, dog-like tracks that instead of the standard four toe pads, inexplicably, had six. One of the Illinois state troopers that night, Officer James Masser, would report that Henry McDaniel appeared rational and sober, and this could have been the final word of the story, but it wasn't over quite yet. For just 11 days later, the creature would return. May 6, 1973. It was around 3 a.m. when Henry McDaniel was suddenly awakened from his slumber by a sound. And as his mind cleared, he realized that what he was hearing were dogs. The dogs of the neighborhood were howling and carrying on. Something was outside. Curious, McDaniel slipped out of bed and walked across the darkened house to his front door, where he once again slipped outside into the night to see if he could spot whatever it was that had agitated the neighbor's animals. Then, something caught his eye.
I seen something moving out on the railroad track, and there it stood. I didn't shoot at it or anything. It started on down the railroad track. Wasn't in a hurry or anything.
And once again, it simply vanished into the night, leaving Henry McDaniel standing alone with no answers, but only questions. By now, the report had gone public, and the word of the McDaniels' encounters was beginning to spread. And while Enfield citizens spent their days laughing and mocking the thought of a monster being in their tiny town, at night, they were still locking their doors and barring their windows. The media, paranormal researchers, thrill seekers, and the simply curious alike were all descending on the area. And with this sudden influx of outsiders flooding into Enfield, Illinois, others would come forward, claiming to have seen McDaniel's three-legged fiend. Local authorities struggled to contain the situation as chaos threatened to spill into the streets. Then, on May 8th of that year, five young men, Michael L. Mogul, age 20, Clifton R. Walden, age 20, Roger M. Tappy, age 19, Randall E. Austin, age 19, and Roger W. Patterson, age 17, would have their own encounter. Tappy would report.
We were a couple 3 miles from McDaniel's place walking along the railroad tracks looking for footprints. Two or three times I thought I heard something. Finally, I told the rest of the guys to go on ahead while I stayed back to try to get a picture of it.
And his plan worked. Almost. For eventually the creature would reveal itself to the young man, but he would fail to take the photo, for with a single glance at that creature's wide, flat face, Roger Tappy abandoned any thought of taking a photograph and instead reached for his gun.
I was scared. It was maybe 50 yards away and sort of covered in brush.
According to Michael Mogul, what the men saw stood 5 feet tall, was covered in a darkish gray hair, and had a wide, flat face. The men opened fire, to which the beast bolted away at an inhuman speed.
I figured the thing to do was to shoot it in the foot. I fired a shot, but I don't think I hit it. Nothing could move that fast with a bullet in it.
Patterson would add,
it wasn't human.
All 5 men would be arrested. Ultimately, 2 of the 5 would be fined for carrying uncased weapons, and the other 2 for not carrying valid hunting licenses. Mogul would be the only one to not be charged, as he simply wasn't carrying a weapon. White County Sheriff Roy Pichard Jr. would state,
these kids, they're out there shooting at anything that moves. Ever since this creature business got started, we got people just milling around with guns and drinking. And if I don't put a stop to it, someone is gonna get killed. I tell you right now, it ends here.
Some sources would even claim that Sheriff Pichard had threatened to arrest McDaniels if he didn't drop the issue of his monster. Eventually, the story of the creature dubbed the Enfield Horror, or Enfield Monster, would simply cease. It didn't end with a bang, but merely a whimper, as sightings of the creature became less and less frequent, until they simply stopped altogether. So, what was this bizarre and misshapen creature that haunted the mines and fields around Enfield? Some would claim it to be alien, or more broadly put, something simply not of this earth, as its twisted biology resembled nothing known to science. They would claim that there were simply no known three-legged species in existence or in the fossil record. However, while it is true that there were no species known to have three legs, the occasional individual did. Francesco Lentini, born May 18, 1889. He would display vestiges of a parasitic twin attached at the base of his spine. It would take the form of a rudimentary set of genitalia and a full-size leg growing from his right hip. He would become world-renowned as a sideshow performer, the great Lentini, and would become legendary as a three-legged wonder, even being billed as the three-legged football player early in his career, where he would simply kick a football across a stage. Skeptics would suggest the tracks were simply that of a dog. However, Henry McDaniel would state that the creature he had seen that night wasn't a dog, nor was it a wolf, coyote, or any other type of canid he was aware of. Others would claim that what the man had seen was a kangaroo, as Illinois was one of the few states it is legal to own such an animal. The short arms, the gray fur, the reflective eyes. Is it possible that McDaniel simply misidentified the animal? That perhaps what he had actually seen was a kangaroo, standing up on its hind legs and leaning back on its thick tail, and in the dark and gloom, he had simply mistaken it for another leg. It would seem to be the most obvious answer, except while serving in the army, Henry McDaniel had been stationed in Australia, and while there, he had owned a pet kangaroo. And even if such a creature did exist, where did it go? If it was in fact from another world, perhaps it simply returned to whence it came. But if it wasn't, if it was a creature spawned of this earth somehow, perhaps with the influx of visitors and monster hunters alike, the creature's habitat had been disrupted enough that it simply moved on, continuing down the L&N railway tracks onto the next town, whatever the case may be. The Enfield Horror remains one of the most intriguing and bizarre cryptid cases in modern history. And whether it is a product of local folklore or perhaps a misidentified animal, or perhaps something beyond our comprehension, the legend of the Enfield Horror serves as a reminder that mysteries still exist in this world, and they are waiting to be uncovered.
Yuck.
Oh. Blech.
Blech.
What the hell? Oh, God. Oh! Yuck.
No, thank you.
Yeah, you know, it's the, you know, again, like, they don't mention this in the story, but, like, what I'm picturing in my head is just, like, a hot bag of garbage. I can't even stand to look at this thing. You're like, the big pink eyes. Like, they don't mention a mouth, but I'm picturing just this...
Slobber?
Yeah!
Yeah.
Like, right? They don't even mention it, but in my head, that's what I'm thinking. Slobber. Mm-hmm. Like not fangs, but just sort of square teeth, but they're all sort of mismatched, like a silverware drawer. Just like, sticking... Ugh, yuck.
Yes.
Yuck. Ew! I'm not a fan. I gotta tell you, I'm not a fan of this.
Me neither.
I feel bad for this guy, because I kind of feel like, you know, I shouldn't be grossed out by him just because he's icky. You know.
Right. We should not be so judgy.
But thank you. That is the word I'm looking for. Thank you, Laura. I shouldn't be so judgy. But part of me is like, sometimes you can judge the book by its cover, and that cover is fucking hideous. Okay. Yuck. But yuck. I'm not a fan.
Oh.
I'm sure he's got a great personality. But I'm not gonna find out because I'm not going near him. He's disgusting. Yuck.
You're very judgy.
I am. I can't help it. I'm sorry.
Someday. Okay, Sam.
Yes, Laura, what's going on? What's happening?
Our next guest.
Oh.
I have been a fan for a very long time, and tonight I finally get to meet them, like, face-to-face, and I'm so excited. I'm kind of fangirling.
It's not Lorenzo Lamas, because I would make this very awkward.
It is not Lorenzo Lamas.
Oh, thank God. Okay.
This person is a very dear friend of mine. Online.
Okay. That's basically the real world these days. That's fine. You're doing okay.
I know. You don't know who it is, do you?
No.
Okay.
No, I have no. You don't tell me these things because you're terrified I will sabotage them.
Right. It is the one and only.
Harrison Ford. It's Harrison Ford, right?
You are correct.
Yes.
Yes.
I am so. I love that man. I love Indiana Jones. I love Han Solo. This is what I asked for Christmas, and I thank you.
Welcome, Harrison Ford.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Yes, my sincere pleasure.
That is not Harrison Ford. That's Rob Fuck Sucking Morphe.
Ha!
Yes.
Holy shit.
The inimitable.
The undescribable.
The one and only Fuck Sucking Rob Morphe.
Laura, take a back seat here for a second. Rob, I got to tell you right now that I am so goddamn giddy to meet you. This is fucking fantastic. This is better than Harrison Ford. He's just some grumbly old man. This is Rob. Fuck sucking Morphe, Laura.
I'm fangirling too over here.
Well, let this be a mutual appreciation society because you guys are absolutely brilliant. And my heart is pumping like thrice hard right now. So thank you for having me on, guys. It's a real honor.
So I got to say, I don't know if people understand the depth of your contribution to this community. Okay. Because I know, look. Your stuff, your not just the artwork, but the stuff you have written, like the amount of stuff. And I know it's contributed a lot because I see it get stolen constantly. Constantly.
Oh, my.
Oh, I know it's good. I know it's good because it's everywhere. So could you take just a second to just fill the people in on your accomplishments? Because it's quite something.
Well, I appreciate that. Obviously, I am flattered. I'm not sure if it quite we'll live up to the expectations, but I will say this. Well nigh a quarter of a century ago, back in 2000, I, with my buddy Mark Storrs and another buddy of ours, Mike DeForest, started a little website called American Monsters, which just covered the spectrum of weird stuff. And it was created in support of a documentary, a still unseen documentary that we made about the Honey Island Swamp Monster, which, of course, was inspired by... the phenomenal In Search Of episode based on the same creature way back in the 70s. So we built this website, which eventually morphed into Cryptopia. And you know, I've written scads of articles, mostly for the websites, for Cryptopia and American Monsters, for magazines and different blogs and other places. And then Mark Storrs and I and our friend Chris Carnicelli, 6 years ago, hard to believe, we just had our anniversary.
Wow.
I know, it blows my mind, began the Cryptonaut podcast. wherein we took this knowledge base and decided to drink heavily and have a hell of a lot of fun talking about all of these weird ass monsters that we've adored since childhood. I should put a little disclaimer on that, that Mark and I have enjoyed since childhood. Chris could give zero fucks, but he likes drinking with his friends and he's an awesome contributor. So I guess, I mean, I don't think that lives up to the hype, Sam, though I thank you very much for it. But that is the basic story of Rob Morphy and his relationship with monsters in the 21st century.
I love it.
Just accept the goddamn compliment. Just accept it.
I mean, yeah, sure. And I'm hung like a log. Yeah, no, it's all of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, and I don't know if the people have seen you, but you're a beautiful bastard. My God, it's like looking in a mirror. My God.
Gorgeous.
Look, I don't know how you do with human women, but with female Bigfoots, you would be cleaning up. All right. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, well, if you know, if I ever go English, so to speak, I mean, I'm in there like swimwear. Obviously, there's been rumors around, you know, the family dinner table, there might be a little squatch in the old gene pool, and you know what, I'm honored to have that if that's the case. Smidgen Neanderthal, a big dappling of Sasquatch, and who knows what else. And the fact that that you think I'm pretty, literally, you just, you know what, I'm going to the crypto prom and I'm going to be the prettiest belle at the ball. Aww. Thank you, Sam.
This warms my heart.
Rob, how did you actually get started? Like, was it the TV show In Search Of?
Yeah, but my mom more than anything. And it's interesting. So here's where you guys get a little scoop. I interviewed her, and that will hopefully be on soon. But my mom has always been, she's like open-minded and awesome and cool. I'm not going to digress on how cool moms are, but you know, we've talked about this, Laura, like just, you know, the parental influence.
Yeah.
But she had an active interest in a lot of this stuff because she had a lot of genuine experiences, which, you know, I've had a sampling, like a little sample platter, a little tasting. Like, I've had a flight of paranormal. She's had like full on pissed drunks of paranormal.
Right.
But she doesn't give shits. She's like, she has these experiences and then it moves on and it doesn't matter. It just was integrated in part of her life. So my mom's interest in these things, UFO sightings, she has had cryptozoological paranormal. A lot of people are like, oh yeah, somebody says all that and you're a kid and you're influenced. Trust me. It's like, it's not even a part of her life. It's like, this is just some shit that happened. But I also went shopping that day. I also bought a new purse. This is not important to me.
That's like my mom.
Right on.
Yes.
So because of that, she would watch In Search Of with me. She would watch that old show that was loosely based on Project Blue Book, which I think was called Project UFO. And I remember being 4 or 5, very young, in the mid to late 70s, and watching it going, oh my God, this is fascinating. All of these crafts and creatures and what's going on. And then as I got older and researched it and found out that they were based, you know, ostensibly on real cases, I was like delighted. So I will say that pop culture ephemera, like In Search Of, like Project UFO, like the old, like Rod Serling narrated documentaries about like ancient astronauts and ancient mysteries, all of these things that would be played on reruns on, like, you know, the New York channels that we got up here in upstate New York, definitely made a huge mark on me. Of course, The Legend of Boggy Creek, which to me just blew my mind as a kid. It's like, oh my God, this really happened. And this is incredible. All of these things had a huge and indelible mark on me, but it is my mom's firsthand accounts, which I had kept quiet for the longest time because she was, like I say, she was just who she was in her 50s. And she's like, I don't know if I want everyone knowing about this. And I'm like, yeah, I've always respected the anonymity of my sources, period. If it's the woman who gave birth to me, all the more so. But lately she's been like, you know what? She did this interview with me and she's like, and again, it's going to be released on the Kryptonaut podcast soon. It's like, I want people to know her experiences are extraordinary. And they blew my mind as a kid. And so you think, all right, and granted, you're a kid and, you know, you just have to trust me that I trust my mom, but whatever. You're like, the person that raises me and feeds me and takes care of all of my shit says, this is something that happened to her, but she doesn't necessarily believe everything that's out there, but this is that. And then you get the second punch of Leonard Nimoy and In Search Of, Rod Serling and his documentaries, Project UFO. And so as a kid, even though I was interested in horror films and sci-fi and all the things kids are interested in, I've always loved cinema and I've always loved all sorts of things. There was always like this burning ember in the back of my psyche. That's like, this shit can happen because somebody I know and love and trust implicitly tells me this is just a part of my life experience that I, and they're brief, not long lasting, not like years haunting, just experiences. And I'm like, so I know this can happen. I've always been fascinated, in the stories of it. Always love going to the library and reading books about it. So what's funny is all of these things coalesced in me to create an interest. Now, as I got older, like everyone else, I got interested in fucking partying and the opposite sex or the same sex, if that's what you're into. It just isn't what I was into, but I fucking loved all the shit I did that distracted me from it. But I never stopped, sort of like my love of Godzilla movies. I never gave up my love of the paranormal. And then, like I say, just out of the blue, we're going to go on that vacation I talked about earlier. I'm like, let's shoot a documentary. Hey, Mark, let's just build a fucking website. And suddenly I start reimmersing myself and it reignited that ember into like a full blown conflagration of passion and excitement. And then I'd start getting feedback from people like the things I'm putting out there, they're enjoying it. It's like, and so this blows my mind. For some people, I have been there in search of. I have been their thing, and they come back, and that just, so now, 25, 24 years later, technically, I'm like, holy shit, I'm a part of this. I'm not saying a significant part, but I'm a part of the pantheon of paranormal that has helped influence another generation. And just because I had that little spark in me that reignited, I'm bringing something to the field, as you guys are, that is both entertaining and informative and hopefully enjoyable. And so I guess to me, I know I digress a lot and I apologize for all the side paths I go on, but for me, the great delight is the contact I have made with fellow human beings who are extraordinary, that I'm talking about you, Laura Cram, and I'm talking about a handful of others, people that really, it has been a delight to get to know and to understand that this has basically led me on this last phase of my journey that has taken me away from cinema and my other concerns that I still love, and brought me into this place where it's like, holy shit, this is a wonderful, expansive realm of things that we know just a little bit about, but demand us to go deeper so we can really find out the roots of these mysteries, these extraordinary enigmas that have been with the human race forever. And I'm able to do this in a way that A, allows me to meet wonderful people, B, influence people I will never meet, but hopefully in a positive way, and three, ignite the imaginations of young people in a way that, I never meant to be a mentor. I'm absolutely the shittiest mentor. I am, whether or not I deserve to be a mentor aside, knowing that you can leave a positive mark on the world has been one of the greatest delights of my life. So how I got into cryptozoology was pop culture and my mom. What I've done with cryptozoology and paranormal lore in general is hopefully leave a stepping ladder for other people to rise much, much higher than I ever could and pique their curiosity and help the next generation give a fuck about the world around them, whether or not it happens to be enigmatic mysteries or whatever it is. And to be just part of that is literally the greatest honor and joy of my life. And that is a long-winded, weird answer, but that's the one I'm sticking with.
Well, you're in luck because long-winded and weird is like, that's totally our wheelhouse. So you're doing all right.
Thank you.
Okay, so tonight we are talking about the Enfield Horror, which is in Illinois. That's where I am at. And right now there is a tornado watch. So if I just stop talking and I bail out, that's why. So.
You just got Dorothy Gale'd right out of there. We understand.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
But yes, this story does come from Illinois, and not to deep dive too quickly. This is literally one of my favorite accounts in the entirety of cryptozoology.
Wow.
Perhaps even ufology, though that is up for, debate at this point. It is an incredible case, and it really epitomizes what I love about discussing these things. Because as much as I love the bread and butter of the Bigfoot, I love you, Sam. I love your
elephant. I know you do. I know you do.
And Nessie is my all-time favorite. My little baby Nessie, I love. Don't be offended. You're right up there. The weird shit is the stuff that really, to use the parlance of our day, pumps my nads. I love it. And Enfield Horror epitomizes this sort of batshit crazy cryptid that is what keeps me going back to the well. So, So I'm so glad not only just to be here and be a part of this extraordinary podcast in this wonderful organization, but I'm also delighted that you brought me on for this particular case because it is one of my all-time favorites.
Well, and honestly, other than maybe Lauren Coleman, I don't know who else I would rather have on here talking about this. So Thank you so much for being here with us. And Lauren Coleman said, fuck off. So that's why you're here. So thank you.
Yeah, no, I definitely should be the second choice. Yeah. That man is not only like truly a legend, but he was boots on the ground.
Yeah.
We can't talk about the Enfield Horror without talking about Lauren Coleman, because that dude, before it was cool, before it was hip, when, you know, they were still doing documentaries on the radio, God bless him, he went out on his own dime and looked into this case. And that has to be respected and lauded. So yeah, Lauren Coleman first and foremost, but for a second choice, I am honored to be it.
Thank you. Thank you for being our second choice.
The amount of times I hear that is staggering, and yet I'm always delighted. Just, I'm here at the party. I'm glad.
All right. So Rob, can you tell us all about Enfield in the 1970s?
So here's the thing. It's a small town in Illinois. It's just workaday, you know, rail yards, factory workers, the whole nine yards, the things you'd expect. It is in that like heady post Woodstock, you know, thick of the Watergate. Not that this gets political at all, because one of the delightful things about the Enfield Horror is he don't vote and he gives zero shits about politics. And you know, before like the craziness of the disco era. So in this working class, you know, straight ahead, blue collar American environment, all of a sudden out of the blue, on April 25th, 1973, this creature hops, literally hops, not on one, not on two, but three fuck-sucking legs into a backyard of a poor little kid by the name of Greg Garrett, I think. And what does it do? It's sitting there. And I'm just going to, let me just paint a quick picture. It's about 5 feet tall. It's got oily, green, slippery frog skin. Not green, I'm sorry. Jeez Louise, frogs got in my head. Gray. So that makes it worse somehow. Somehow, if you're like sticky and gray, that's somehow worse.
Yeah.
Giant eyes that were compared to flashlights that are blood red.
Mm-hmm.
Two tiny baby little T-Rex arms jutting out of its torso, which can do nothing. They're vestigial at best. But then, and this is the piece de resistance, three legs. It is a living tripod, unlike anything else you find in the zoological record on Earth. It's got three massive kangaroo-like legs, super strong, talons at the end, of course, because if you can't tear something asunder, what's the point of being a monster? And it can hop. It knows how to use these three legs. I think one of my, you know, greatest like mind palace visits, I have a little side room somewhere off the West Wing where it's just various versions of the Enfield Horror running. For my delight and me trying to figure out how it moves, running and hopping. So this thing hops over a back fence into this little kid's yard, this poor Greg Garrett, and he's just hanging out and he's like, oh, I'm a kid. You're a hideous monster. And all of a sudden, this thing, for reasons I cannot imagine, decides to tear his effing sneakers apart with his claws. And that is the very first case of the Enfield Horror. He shows up, eye-to-eye contact with a human being, a small child, understandably terrified, even more so once his keds are torn to ribbons, and this thing hops away, and this kid goes, you know, weeping to his parents, understandably, saying, you know, this icky tripod just effed up my school shoes. And if a monster flap can start any cooler than that, I'm not aware of it.
So you're saying a tore up his shoes while he was wearing them?
While he was wearing
them. What the fuck? What the hell is that?
The feet were victimized as well.
Yeah, yeah. And we're sure that this isn't like the kid just screwed up his shoes and used the monster's excuse. Like, I didn't do it. It was a monster. He did it.
Dog ate my homework, screwed up my shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a valid, Sam, that's a very, you know, and I like your skeptical bent, because that is what we have to do. We can't just go wholesale into this stuff and think, oh, yeah, it's always a monster. Everything a child says, I'm going to say, quoting my dear friend that I mentioned earlier, Mark Storrs, the whimsy of a child is that you cannot always trust the veracity of what they say. But here's the kicker. He is not the only one to see it. He's not even the only one that day to see it. And the preponderance of eyewitness evidence lends me to say, I guess, without hesitation, this thing happened to him. He's not fibbing because everyone else around him seems to have seen it, and it gets even more terrifying from there.
Oh.
Now, has anyone tried to contact this Garrett kid?
Well, I can only say that I haven't, because I'm terribly negligent when it comes to investigations. I am an armchair crypto historian, and that's the term I prefer, and historian of unknown things. And I will look into it. And I know people have contacted him actually at some point or another. What he had to say later on in life, I'm not sure. But what I do know, because it just goes without saying, had he debunked it, had he said, I was talking smack, I was a kid, I didn't know what was going on, I effed up my shoes, I didn't want to get in trouble, that would have been out there loud and clear. Because as we all know, everyone in this field knows, if somebody sees something extraordinary and weird, it is a whisper that is constantly ridiculed. If somebody, anybody says, even if it's like a third aunt twice removed at a distance, says, oh, wait, no, this was BS, it is a clarion call that is on all of the headlines. So the fact that we don't know this to be bunk suggests to me, I can't say I know it for a fact, that he has never changed his story.
And so then after that, now it gets seen again.
Yeah.
The same day.
Half hour later.
Like next door, right?
If not next door, like across, like very close, same neighborhood, same, like literally, I guess next door. I don't know why I'm qualifying. You were right, Laura. I don't know why I did that. I just mansplained next door for no good reason. And I'm a dick for it. And the fact that I can
own
it means I'm growing. I'm growing as a person. And that makes me feel good.
I accept your apology.
Here's the thing. The McDaniel house is nearby. This being 73, Henry McDaniel Jr., obviously the son of Senior, and his little sister, who has only been called Lil, perhaps short for Lily, I don't know, are at home alone. And so what happens is, again, half hour later, just down the street, they heard a scratching sound at the front door. And, you know, they're like, okay, what is it? Curiosity gets piqued. So young Henry opens the door, and, you know, he's expecting to see a stray dog, maybe a rabid raccoon. That's the worst case scenario in his mind. But when he opens it up, he comes face to face. Excuse me. I'm laughing because I just delight in what this would be a great moment for dramatic reenactors. I don't know why this hasn't been in more documentaries or really any that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. To open the door and you see this like oozing monstrosity that, you know, probably still has parts of sneakers trapped in its claws from where it attacked poor Garrett kid. It's there. Henry Jr. looks. It looks at him. It's back and forth. It's an exchange. And then, bam, door gets slammed. So he's trying to put on a brave face for his little sister. But as he goes over to her, they hear this thing's talons ripping into the wood of the door. It's shredding it. It's not satisfied with the no thank you, man. It's like, I'm trying to get in. So he grabs his sister, gets into the middle of the room because they don't want to be near a wall or a window or anywhere that this thing can tear through. And all of a sudden, his facade begins to fall apart because when, at first, let me digress here. His facade, being the brave facade, is maintained because he knows there's a monster scratching at the door and he's got to protect his little sister. It falls silent for just a moment and he's like, I got my shit. It's gone. I collected it. I'm being a good big bro. Then the fucking air conditioner starts rattling and this thing is trying to rip the air conditioner out to come in through the window, much easier than ripping through a door. So at this point, he's a bundle of tears and mayhem, and so is the sister, and they are weeping, holding each other, when not long later, at about, say, 9:30 at night, his mom and dad finally come in. So Henry Sr. and his wife walk through. They find their kids just babbling and like in sheer panic, totally worried what's going on, and they recount how this, you know, quote unquote thing had tried to break into the house while the parents were gone, and that it was then, excuse me, when, you know, the dad's like, okay, you know, kids are panicking, whatever. He hears the same scratches. So he goes to the door and skeptically, one has to assume, opens it cavalier, you know, just cocksure like a dad's want to be. Whips it open to his children's chagrin, I might add. They know what's going on. And this courageous man turns into goop because standing there on the stoop is the same red-eyed, three-legged, sharp fucking clawed, tiny baby T-Rex armed fucking tripod that had been haunting everyone in this town. So he stumbles back in terror, runs to the closet door, pulls out his 22, goes back, pops a cap in this creature because that's what you have to do. And it's 73.
How tall is this thing again?
It's between 4 and 5 feet tall, okay. Often erring on the taller side. The problem is, and one of the great delights for artists like myself who like to illustrate these things, but the real problem is that you get these very evocative descriptions. You get the three legs, you get the slimy gray, not green, as I mentioned earlier, skin. You get these flashlight sized, brilliant red eyes. You get all of these elements, the baby T-Rex arms, but you don't get an accurate depiction. Like some people draw this like hella muscular kangaroo like thing. Other people like me, when I drew it, it's just this sloppy. It's like Belial from Basket Case, but with like stronger legs.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, so for artists, it's a dream come true. You can do it. It's carte blanche. But for the rest of the world, we really honestly, besides these key features, don't know what it actually looked like. Mm-hmm. All right. So Dad shoots this thing. And then he later reported to the police that, 4.5 feet tall, all the things I just said, and it was trying to get into his house. But when he hits it, it does not roll over dead. It does not run away in terror. And this is a quote, hissed like a wildcat at the dude who shot it. Not just once, by the way, 4 times. And he knows he hit it, or at least that's what he reported to the cops. And then it shoots off. So it attacks a kid, kills his kids, tries to break into a house. Who knows what it's going to do to, like, you know, Junior and Lil. Dad comes home, shoots it 4 fucking times. It turns and hisses like it's merely inconvenienced and kind of pissed, and then escapes.
My God. Jesus Christ. This is, look, okay. I mean, right out of the gate, I just got to ask. The three legs. I mean, obviously that's the thing. That's what's sticking in my head because I'm trying to wrap my head around. Is it like three legs in a row? Is it like 2 legs and 1 leg sticking out the back, like backwards, like a tripod? Like how the fuck are these legs? Like this is driving me crazy.
Sam, excellent questions all. And guess what?
We don't know.
You will find no relief because nobody knows. It was never stated like 2 feet pointed forward, 1 back. All were pointing forward. Did it have hooves? I mean, we know it had claws. So that part I'm being a dick about. Yes, it had fucking claws. But it was structured in a way that and because we don't have tripodal animate objects on this planet, generally speaking, there is no way to actually know how it was structured or what the accurate sort of anatomical design would be. That's part of what haunts you and part of what, you know, again, if you're an interpretive artist, delights you. But it pisses me too, Sam. It really does.
And the little tiny baby arms. Like, what is that? That doesn't even make sense. It's like, I don't know. I know. Enzo Tech shoes. Shoes.
Why shoes?
What the hell they ever do to you? Yeah.
I mean, is it, you know, is a guy that likes loafers? Does it prefer boat shoes? I mean, is it a flip-flop kid? I don't know why it hates sneakers. It does, clearly, or maybe, and let me go dark here, it just wanted to debilitate the child's feet so it could torture and play with it before it ate it. Now, that's me going wildly speculative. There's no indication this thing is a flesh eater and or wanted to toy with its prey like a cat before it ate it. But then again, there's no evidence that it did not want to do that.
Whoa.
That is possible.
But his feet were fine, right? It was just his sneakers that got torn up.
So here's the thing, Laura. It is not known if he had scratches, some gouges. If they were a bloody mess, it would have been reported, one assumes.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. That's another terrible gap in the reporting. And that's also because most of these accounts don't come from investigators, though Lauren Coleman, again, just this intrepid investigator, went down and did what he could do. But most of these accounts come from local newspaper accounts, and being a former small town newspaper reporter, I can assure you, when you're dealing with some local shit that you give zero shits about, you are phoning it in. You don't care. You're like, okay, yeah. Now, I would think somebody would be a little more delighted by the fact that there's a monster in the town and it's not like the PTA meeting or a school board or some dumb shit. You know, if me being me as a local reporter, I would have like milked that for all it was worth. But this dude or lady apparently gave no fucks at all and just wrote down the bare minimum. Sneakers got tore up. It hopped away. Suck it. So that's the historians okay. we're working with here.
Yeah, and you know, and honestly, you're spot on there, because I will tell you there are other versions of this story where McDaniel is a bachelor. The kids aren't even mentioned. There's other versions where he doesn't have kids. There's other versions where he doesn't even have a wife. You know, it's crazy. The story just begins with him opening the door. They skip the whole shit about the kids.
Yeah,
which is the best part of the story. So.
Yeah.
I mean, the kids being scared is the precedent that establishes a vengeful father who at first is ridiculing the kids, like over exaggeration of a moment, just figuring they're scared, sees it and is like, oh my God, this thing almost got my babies, gets his gun, shoots it 4 times, and this thing hisses, thus, you know, emasculating him. Surely, I don't want to go deep psych, but come on, he couldn't have felt good at that night. And so that is the precedent that establishes how terrifying and powerful an encounter this is. And when you take that out, that's a problem. And so here's where, and I thank you for playing into this, my status as a self-proclaimed crypto historian comes in. You can't always know the facts, but it is important to get as many of them as humanly possible, to corroborate when you can, to compile them in a way where you have to make decisions, because like you're saying, you'll get people that say, you know, he was an alien space waitress and, you know, just came home from a shift, and you'll get all sorts of crazy shit. But then you've got to be like, all right, what are most of these accounts saying? And when you find one that is closer to the source, in this case, Lauren Coleman, in this case, a handful of reporters are at the scene and they're really describing what's going on, then, and you can authenticate it to any degree, then you proclaim that to be not the simple truth, because we'll never know the simple truth. We can only just do our best to dig at the past, but the closest version of the truth we can find. And that's super important in cryptozoological and ufological, paranormal cases in general, because it's very easy to get into the highlights, like, oh, here's a medley of the greatest hits of this monster, and I don't really mm-hmm. care about the facts. But getting into the minutia is really where the gems live. And you know, I mean, I think it goes without saying, your listeners and fans will certainly sense this about me. I mean, I like a good story. I want it to be entertaining. I don't want it to be entertaining at the expense of truth, but I want it to be entertaining in that the more authentic moments you can portray, the more exciting and engaging it is for human beings, because all of a sudden you put yourself in the shoes of, you know, poor Greg Garrett or poor Lil and, you know, Henry Jr. And you're like, I remember being a kid. I remember being scared of shit that wasn't real. These kids had to deal with face-to-face confrontations with the horrific unknown, and this thing wasn't necessarily nice, wasn't necessarily not a predator. It didn't kill or eat them, but you don't know what it might have done. And to me, that's where I apologize for the digression, that's the exciting part about getting into the details of these stories and trying to find the closest sources to the actual accounts.
Yeah, this feels like E.T. if E.T. had rabies.
A movie.
I don't know if you guys know this, but E.T. was originally supposed to be a horrific retelling of the Hopkinsville Kelly Goblins case. And Rick Baker, legendary makeup effects artist, created these really scary versions of them. And it was all going to go green light ahead, like after Raiders of the Lost Ark, or while it was being made, that was going to be Spielberg's next film. But then, speaking of your guest tonight, Harrison Ford, his then wife, whose name I'm sad to say escapes me, who ended up becoming the author, the screenwriter of E.T., was like, oh no, Steve, you can't make it dark and grim and based on a true story. Let's make this sweet story about, you know, a kid who needs a dad and he gets an alien with a weird finger. Fine. It's a cute film. I'm okay with it. I loved it when I was 9. It's good. But there's always going to be a part of me that dies a little on the inside every time I think Steven Spielberg in his prime almost made a fucking adaptation of the Hopkinsville Kelly Goblin case, which might have been the greatest. I mean, look what he did for UFOs right. with Close Encounters. Look what he did for Sharks with Jaws, with movie serials and Raiders yeah. of the Lost Ark. Oh, Ghost, Poltergeist in particular, with Poltergeist, which we all know he secretly directed. God bless you, Toby Hooper. So that having been said, in an alternate reality, if we could trade beta tapes with another reality and another dimension, I would kill to see the original horror based on the Hopkinsville Goblin case that it could have been.
Oh, that would have been so good.
Yeah, yeah. Did they get so far as to actually write a script for it?
I don't know.
Ah, damn it.
I know that there were treatments. I know they went so far as that Rick Baker, you know, multiple Academy Award winning practical effects artist from the day, you know, won the first Academy Award, I think, for American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
He actually still has the maquettes, the head designs of the Hopkinsville-esque. Obviously, they were taking, you know, licenses with the original story, but the scary aliens that were supposed to be attacking the farmhouse. And God, I can only imagine this young man, the master of his craft, showing this poor family besieged by nefarious alien forces. I mean, our E.T.'s okay in the foggy shed and all that shit. Okay, I'm all right with all of it.
Yeah.
But the more I think about it, the more pissed I get. So let's just get back on topic, because right now I'm just going to get fucking angry.
All right. And so the McDaniels live near a railroad track, right?
Yes. The Ellen End Railroad, which makes sense. It's barren at night. There's not a lot going on. It's a big open expanse. There's places mm-hmm. for it to hide. So it could have hopped anywhere. I'm not saying it was an intelligent decision or that it was like thinking, oh, yes, no, perfect place for concealment. But it ended up working really well, because after the McDaniels incident, that's where it escaped to. And this will play in. But let me stop before we go that deep. The press reaction to this, and this is to me very interesting. White County Roy Pichard Jr. was so perturbed by the sudden influx, of press and curiosity seekers, not to mention the alarm that was settling in on the locals. So the Garrett and the McDaniel case are in the press and people are starting to get really concerned. He threatened, and this is almost like redneck Men in Black, to incarcerate Henry McDaniel Sr. if he didn't stop inciting panic by spreading his wildly terrifying tale. So it hops away and it's gone into the, you know, the vast gravelly expanses of the Ellen End Railroad. But when it comes out in the paper the next day, people are freaking out. Their kids could be in jeopardy. It attacked a child. Didn't hurt him, really, but it attacked a child. It tried to attack two other kids. It is seemingly bulletproof, and it is still on the loose. And so this guy's just telling his story, and the local, you know, constabulary says, oh no, you're not. People are going to lose their shit, and I'm going to put you in jail if you keep telling this story, which I'm not saying is like some big conspiracy, but it is really indicative of like how affected this community was at the time.
Obviously, he saw something where people are threatening him.
Absolutely. No, to me, these little tidbits add veracity to the story. But what makes it interesting, and this is so just so prevalent in the 1970s. One of my favorite things about doing stories about the 70s, and this predates it, I think, but like the headless horror of Grafton and things like that. But 60s and 70s were that the community, maybe because cable wasn't a thing, I don't know why, but they got involved in crazy UFO flaps and monster flaps. And one of the things that started happening were well-armed posses of amateur monster hunters began patrolling the area near the Ellen End Railroad track. So so obviously the local cops have to be concerned, you know, well-armed people, probably not entirely sober, armed to the tits, are fucking going out looking for a monster, and they might accidentally just find another person. So, I mean, to like scale it down from conspiracy, this could be a little bit of what Pichard Jr. was worried about. But that still having been said, that was one of the great aspects of it stopped in the 80s, really. But the 60s and prevalent super in the 70s were, if something like this happened in your local community, you went out in force. You got your friends, whether they were teenage buddies or, you know, middle-aged drinking buddies or whatever the hell it was, you got fucking armed and you went out and you made this happen. And I can see where that would alarm the cops, because I mean, a bullet flying through a random window, it could be a tragic thing. So,
right.
I mean, grounding it down, it's there, but that's part of what I love is that It's a full on community engagement thing. That's where fucking festivals and fairs come from. That's how you get Mothman days. That's how you get some of the most enjoyable shit you can do in a small town, because I grew up in one in upstate New York. If you have an event like this, when it starts grassroots, embrace it. But of course, you don't want people killing each other. So I understand the other side of the coin. But I had to add that, because that is really what the cops were concerned with at that time. But it's also one of the most exciting parts of monster sightings of that era.
And I got to say, I love the idea of these things bringing people together. They're out there. They're getting shit done. You can't get a person. Most Americans now, you can't get them off the goddamn couch for anything. Like, remember they just came out and said, hey, by the way, UFOs are real. No one gave a shit.
Nobody gave a shit.
No one fucking cared.
Jesus. Does that not haunt you both, Laura? Sam, does that not, like, it drives me nuts at night. It's like, after all these years, after just shitting on the idea that they would even deign to give fuck one about UFOs, all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah, no, they're real. They're there. And then they might pose a threat. They might not, but they have technology that are far beyond what we have. And we don't know if it's an enemy of the state. We don't know if it's an alien technology, but hey, we're going to look into it. Bye. And nobody gives a shit. Zero fucking buzz in the populace, except for geeks like us. The hell.
Yeah. 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 Three words, non-human intelligence. That's what they said. And I'm like, what the fuck does that mean?
They're upping. Yeah. The first one is just, oh yeah, the Air Force and the Navy pilots are encountering things they can't understand, and they do things we can't believe. Mind blowing enough. Next guy comes out, is like, oh yeah, we got bodies, non-human intelligence. We're not even sure they're aliens. They're probably interdimensional, or they're from inner Earth, or wherever the fudge they're from. Grush, elaborate, please. But we, you know, and then they still give zero fudges. It's like, oh yeah, I guess it's facts now. And you know what? I blame social media and fast food. There, I said it. I know I'm being controversial. Didn't mean to stir up the shit storm, guys, but come on.
That's what we're here for. Now you said it as a joke. You said the social media thing as a joke, but you might actually be spot on. You may be correct. Okay. Because maybe the reason why people aren't getting together anymore and going out and like in posses and looking into this stuff and whatnot is because they're doing it online. You know what I mean? Like they're forming a posse online to investigate. Like, they're not leaving the comfort of their own house, but they're still kind of gathering together, sort of. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And that kind of breaks my heart a little bit, you know?
They can hide behind their screen. They can say whatever they want to you, and they can just hide. Use a fake name.
I'm going to out myself as a middle-aged old man here when I say this, but I will say this. When the closest thing to getting people excited about going out and hunting an anomalous monster is Pokemon Go.
Oh yeah.
We are living in a dark time. It's not that I have faith in society. I'm an optimist. I think things are going to work out. I think kids are smarter and better, and I wish all the best to them. I do not think that we were, you know, geniuses that were doing everything fucking right back in the 80s and 90s, because that's absurd. But I will say this. When you're confronted with this kind of batshit craziness, you have to be willing to just embrace it a little. I wasn't born behind a screen, though. I mean, I've lived behind one plenty of times, and I'm not judging it. Shit, it's fun. I as I told you, I'm an armchair fucking crypto historian. I go into the field only under like penalty of death half the time. I don't even like to rough it. I don't even like to wear my strong shoes. I want to wear fucking the most comfortable shit possible. So I'm not judging. But when something like this happens, if something like Enfield happened today, you would get some buzz. It would be like the aliens in the Florida mall thing, if indeed there were. And there'd be some hype, and there'd be people claiming they were there and people claiming they weren't. But you wouldn't, and this is not a judgment call, it's just a difference in time. Back then, if something happened locally, you were used to going out, you were used to, you know, filling a car with your friends, you were used to like doing the crazy shit. Now people are used to, like you say, getting online and breaking it down. It wouldn't happen.
Right.
Because this is the world we live in. So be that as it may, I would love to think I don't know. I mean, are there well-armed posses outside of that Miami mall? Maybe it's not a bad thing, actually.
I will say, I think the last case that I can remember that involved technically a posse
getting together was the Alabama Leprechaun.
Oh my God.
That's the last time. That's the last time I remember anything like that happening.
You're not wrong. You're absolutely not wrong. And that's, hey, you got a leprechaun infestation. You got to deal with that.
You got to take care of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's gold at stake, for the love of God.
It's hard times. You got to get yours any way you can.
Exactly. Let's bring it back to, let's bring it back to Illinois. Let's bring it back to 73. Let's make this happen. Yeah.
It's appreciated. Yeah. Bring us back. Bring us back.
So the third sighting, brief, bizarre, not really a lot of information about it, but five young, of course, unidentified men had, you know, allegedly had a run-in with a creature identical to the one that Greg Garrett and the McDaniels et al. Encountered, with the notable addition that they described the thing as hairy, which is weird because, you know, this is not of the squatchy variety. This is of the amphibious, slimy bog monster variety. But what the hell? You have to take the eyewitness accounts as they come. You can't just make it convenient. So they described it three-legged, big red-eyed, all the whole nine yards, baby T-Rex arms, but hairy. The men discovered the beast, again, allegedly, hiding in the underbrush and proceeded to open fire on it. But much like in the McDaniel case, their bullets were unable to kill the thing, and the monster bolted off at a speed that the witnesses surmised was in excess of any that a human being might be able to achieve. Which is, again, another testament, assuming it's true, another testament to it not being a kid in a costume, three-legged costume that's 4.5 feet tall, very awkward anyway. I mean, that's like literally it's a biological tripod like R2-D2, except fleshier, scarier, and hates sneakers more. But anything that can run that fast, period, at that size is amazing. But it certainly is not going to be a kid or a small, you know, human being in a costume.
Now, they said it ran, but the other accounts have been hopping or leaping, right?
Yes, almost all of them.
Okay.
So this thing is capable of running, Laura, and I'm glad you pointed out, but it is absolutely renowned for its leaping capabilities. Like there are some things that, you know, that can jump, phantom kangaroos, the Falkville Metal Man was said to make preternaturally long jumps, but this thing seems to be structured. So again, we don't know its biology, but I keep thinking like it's using the third leg, like a kangaroo might use its tail, balancing down and then using all three legs to launch hardcore. Mm-hmm. So it's a parkour master, just up in the air, go. I mean, sometimes 20 feet, sometimes more. It's stupid how far this thing can jump. So you're absolutely right. Though I said running, it was probably a weird loping combination of sprint, leap, dig the claws back into the dirt, launch again. And again, when I told you that,
that's crazy to think about.
Uh-huh. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but part of my mind palace is a room dedicated to all the iterations I can concoct of the Enfield horror running and jumping. It is because it is a delightful mind exercise. Who the fuck mm-hmm. knows how it did it, but it was apparently doing it, and it was doing it with extraordinary alacrity and finesse. And that alone, I mean, you know, you gotta appreciate athletes at the top of their game, and this guy was one.
I can't imagine seeing that. Like, I don't even know what I would do.
Well, I mean, I know what I would do.
Throw a rock at it.
Well, yeah, maybe I would throw a rock at it after I got done crapping the pants I don't wear. I mean, yeah, maybe.
Yeah. No pants are safe in this thing's world.
But here's the deal, man. I got a couple things going on here. A, look, I know it's smaller than me, so I shouldn't be that scared, right? But then mm-hmm. there's B, and B is, what the hell is that thing? What the hell is that thing? Okay, look. And it starts jumping around. It's like, it's super fast. And it's got those weird little arms that don't do anything in the weird, gross skin. Look, I'm going to tell you right now. I feel like that thing could get to me faster than I could draw a gun. All right. And I don't like that. Mm-mm. I don't even carry a gun. And then still the thought scares the shit out of me. You know what I'm saying?
The only thing that could make it worse, if it had a mouthful of fangs.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't know what its mouth looked like, or if indeed it had one.
Yeah.
But we do know it's staring at you. And it's wiggling its tiny little malformed fingers. Again, I'm taking dramatic license, but let me paint a picture with its super muscular, ultra buff Usain Bolt hopping legs.
Oh,
with the fucking the raptor talons that you know are going to make your innards go out. And that's a problem.
Ugh.
I keep thinking like the gray skin and like how it's hairy. Like I'm picturing like elephant skin.
That's interesting.
You know, I solved it. It's an elephant.
I think you're absolutely right. Hairy and gray is completely indignant. Like, no, a baby three-legged elephant. Mm-hmm. Two-legged elephant that uses its trunk, and everyone got confused. Assumed it's a three. No, I think you nailed it, Laura. I mean, I think right now we can quit knowing we are the kings of cryptozoology. Kings and queens, excuse me. Yeah, because you did it. So the queen goes first, as always, and should.
Yes.
So, all right. Besides the fact that we solved it in cryptozoology, can now go on to other things. I will say this. Mm-hmm. It's never been described as being wrinkly. Unlike, say, the Pascagoula abductors, which were these weird, like, carrot-nosed and ears, robotic things with crab claws, they were described as being elephantine in the sense that they had these dense wrinkles all over their gray bodies. This thing... It hasn't been described as being smooth, but it has never been described as being overtly wrinkly. And one of the things
you're just shooting down my theory.
I'm not shitting on it. You solved the puzzle. I understand that. But let me be the devil's advocate. Let me be the lone voice of dissent in the darkness that will eventually fade away, like Galileo. Oh no, I'm being a dick there. I'm sorry. He came back hard. But what I will say, no, in all seriousness, when they talk about it being oily, mucus covered, viscous. To me, that seems, though it doesn't necessarily say, it might be more amphibious. And so maybe this is my default again, as a good old fashioned crypto historian. Whenever something is biologically indistinct, let's say, whenever there is no record of it in the zoological record, whenever there is no way for this thing to have a breeding population of any reasonable size without us knowing about it, except for this one fucking case, I always say, hey, maybe it lives in the water. Who knows? It's probably wet a lot.
I gotta tell you guys, this is causing some gears to turn in my head, and I got one word for you: mutant. Okay, a mutant. mutation. Oh, all right. Look, you're talking about something with three big, powerful legs, two little tiny arms, and big eyes, okay? And it's got, you've described as having, you know, not potentially wrinkly skin, but kind of, you've described amphibious, sort of frog-like, gross skin, right? Now, I live in Minnesota. We had a long history of, like, all these mutations being caused on frogs here in Minnesota because of various toxins and poisons being dumped, you know, by farmers into lakes and all this other stuff, right? Now, a lot of those had like multiple limbs, okay? Like they had like three legs, you know, and two little arms, and now you got the big eyes. I'm telling you.
Same height, right? I'm
maybe it made it bigger than normal, okay? Maybe not 5 feet tall, but, you know, I don't, like a bullfrog, you know, that's been like mutated and shit. Who knows? You know, like, I'm just saying. I'm spitballing here, but it's not the craziest thing I've ever heard, you know?
All right. Are we getting up to the rainbow guy?
We are getting to Rick Rainbow.
Yeah.
The improbably named Rick Rainbow.
I love it.
Fucking wow. I mean, he's not Wolfman Jack, but you know what he is? A motherfucking DJ. And DJs were the fucking gods of the 70s. Bless them. If you watch American Graffiti, granted a 70s movie set in the 50s, you understand the power of the DJ to be the coherent thread through the random mundanities and adventures of your life. And this dude, Rick Rainbow, from station WWKI in Kokomo, Indiana, was applying his trade and fucking changing the lives of the youth. But what he did, and this is technically of this flap, the final eyewitness to this improbable creature, not necessarily de facto the final eyewitness, because again, and I say this very conservatively, 1 in 10 people that see things report it. That's super conservative.
Yeah.
It could be 1 in 30, it could be 1 in 25, but it is magnificently different. The amount of people that report, and we're dealing with reports here, are usually significantly lower than the amount of people who see. But the final eyewitness we know about is Rick Rainbow, who served as news director of said WWKI station in Kokomo. And so he and three other, as usual, sadly, unidentified individuals claim to have seen a stooping gray 5-foot-tall entity lurking outside, an abandoned house not far from the homes of both Garrett and McDaniels. So not necessarily L&N Railroad, but nearby. Although they did not have nearly as close an encounter as the previous witnesses, Rainbow and his crew did manage to do one thing the others had not. Tape record the creature's disturbing scream.
Yes.
And you love that because hearing a monster is second only to seeing a monster.
Right.
And you hate that because that fucking recording is nowhere to be found.
God damn. Come on.
Which is a dick kicker.
We assume that he played it on air, right?
I have to.
We don't know.
I mean, if he didn't, then that man doesn't deserve to be the news director in Kokomo. I'll tell you that right now. That's Bush League. He almost certainly played it. He found it. He played it. I'm assuming, don't know this for a fact, but I'm assuming Lauren Coleman heard it at some point. I'm assuming that most of the people within the range of the radio tower heard it. Why no one recorded it, or if indeed they did, why it never got made public, I don't know. Now, I don't know radio protocols in the day. I know a lot of TV stations, local TV stations, would keep covering the tapes over and over and over again because these things were expensive. And they didn't mm-hmm. see live TV as something that was worth preserving. They saw it as some way to make a quick buck, put shit out there. You needed to keep churning out new stuff. And that's the thing. Everything that's valuable in life, this is not going to come as a shock to anyone who's intelligent, but fucking is because people didn't understand that people would care about this. They didn't understand the value of nostalgia. They didn't understand the value of history. So it goes away, like comic books, like Mad Magazine, like baseball cards. That shit goes away because it's ubiquitous and nobody gives fucks until none of it's left. And then you're like, shit. And it seems like the recording of the Enfield Horror screeching inhumanly and horrifically and all the sounds, again, I can concoct all the sounds in my mind, we don't know, are lost to the ages now. Unless somebody turns up a recording, boy, wouldn't that be dope.
Sam, can you give us your best impression of what you think it sounds like?
What? No.
It's a shame.
Look. If you guys ask me, hey, Sam, do an impersonation of a kangaroo, all right? I couldn't even do that. And that's an animal I've seen a billion times. And I don't know what those sound like. I have no idea. All right.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't know what a kangaroo sounds like.
Exactly. Now, you're asking me an animal or creature that I have nothing to go on. Nothing. I don't know anything about it. I don't even know if it's from this planet. All right. And it makes me sad because as a Bigfoot, I have to let you know we are natural mimics. Okay. We can imitate anything. But I got nothing to go on here. All right. So, what did anyone even describe what the audio possibly sounded like, you know?
Never in all of my research. And I have dug deep. I want to hear it's like somewhere between like a yodeling marmoset and a bullfrog. But nobody said shit.
Damn.
And I have no idea.
Man.
And it haunts me because we should know.
Damn. Yeah, this is upsetting. I don't like this.
No.
All right. Now I'm back. You brought me back down. Thanks, Ralph.
I'm sorry. But Sam, rest assured, this isn't going to necessarily enhance your joy, but things are going to be shifting into high gear because you know who's making the scene? Lauren fucking Coleman.
Yes. Yeah. All right. All right. I'm going back.
Legendary anthropologist and cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman arrived on the scene to investigate the eyewitnesses' claims. While Coleman, never actually saw the creature, he also claimed to have heard with his own ears, not via recording, the haunting cry of the Enfield Horror while searching an area where witnesses had claimed to have seen this fucking thing.
Oh.
So he heard it himself. Now, I'm assuming, though, you know, ask you and me, we know the deal, that he also heard the recording and they might have been comparable. But even neglecting that, he says he heard it himself. And I mean, I don't know how he described it, to be honest. He surely put it in his book, unless he just said it's haunting cry, but I don't know. I do know we heard it, and that's exciting. So this is what he said. This is an actual quote. I traveled to Enfield, interviewed the witnesses, looked at the siding of the house that the Enfield monster had damaged, heard some of the screeching banshee-like sound. So all our discussion was for naught. Clearly, it sounds like an Irish banshee, which has been recorded since the time immemorial, I am sure. I say with all sarcasm.
Okay.
And walked away bewildered.
Oh.
Which is interesting. So, in July 1974, that month's edition of Fate magazine, Lauren Coleman and Jerome Clark, another eminent royal in this field, featured the Enfield Horror in an article entitled, and I love this, and it's got alliteration, which anybody knows me knows is my jam, Swamp Slobs Invade Illinois. Double alliteration. Well played. Coleman even chronicled his discussion regarding this intriguing case with famed paranormal investigator and best-selling author of The Mothman Prophecies, John Keel, in his book, Mothman and Other Curious Encounters. So not only did he chronicle it, he took the time, because he was a peer of, and he happened to be alive at the time, something we all wish we could pick John Keel's mind. What do you think about this motherfucker? I mean, I just love that he did that. Years later, Coleman would compare and contrast the Enfield investigation with another he had conducted regarding a legendary unclassified creature that many also assume was from out of this world, a melon-headed monster known as the Dover Demon. And this is what he said. The Enfield horror was my case investigation. It was much different than the Dover Demon, however, and was more like a combo phantom kangaroo, devil monkey, and swamp ape situation. So here we got a skunk ape, basically swamp ape is the reference to that. The devil monkey, which I'm sure your listeners know, but I will elaborate anyway, are like the tiny, very mean-spirited, super violent cousins of our good friend Sam here. They seem to be crazy, but they're not apes. They're not great apes and or hominids like the Sasquatch. They are basically hyper mean-spirited baboons. So that's kind of fucked up. And then a smidge of just the esoteric batshit craziness of the Dover Demon, which defies description. So Enfield encompasses all these three things, at least according to Lauren Coleman. And I say that's fairly spot on.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I love it.
Oh my God. Yeah. So we'll say, you know what? We'll save. Well, no, fuck it. We're going to do it. I don't care. I was going to say save context for later, but it should also be noted, and this is something I came across in my research, that between 1941 and 1942, in the sleepy village of Mount Vernon, which is just 40 miles away from Enfield, there was a similar spate of encounters involving an anomalous, leaping, that's a quote, beast that terrorized the local populace and was reputedly responsible for numerous animal deaths, which really brings up the gore factor and the horror factor in the region. Eyewitnesses claimed that the Mount Vernon monster was vaguely baboon-like, which of course is going to make you think of devil monkeys and swamp apes again, at least analogously, and was able to leap 20 to 40 feet in a single fucking bound. So, not saying it's an Enfield horror again, not saying anything. A baboon-like thing is not. There's one thing we know: baboons don't have baby T-Rex arms. They don't have three legs. So I'm not going to try to create a huge parallel, but it's interesting that some decades before, like 30 years before, people in that area were seeing this
thing. That's wild. I've never even heard of that thing.
Hmm.
This is wild. All right.
Yeah, I hadn't either, Sam, at all. And then I came across, I'm like, who are you, usurper to the throne?
This guy just shows up, starts pissing on everything, claims it as his own. This is amazing. I love this.
But of course, it shows up 30 years earlier. So it really isn't trying to be a dick and steal. If you steal the thunder in the past, there is an argument to be made. I'm not saying I advocate for it, that technically you were first. Again, I don't know for sure. Just because you happened temporally earlier doesn't mean you're the king of the world. So relax. All right. We live in a world with non-human intelligence that doesn't care about time. So let's just all step off our high horses and look at the facts, which means that technically it came earlier. So therefore it is first. There, I said it. Fuck.
Look, man, technically, you are correct. Yes. However, I just got to point out that, you know what? The GoBots came out a full year before the Transformers did. And right now, no one remembers the freaking GoBots. And meanwhile, the Transformers have had like a billion shitty Michael Bay movies. Okay. So my point is, I don't know if it really matters who came out when, because I feel at this point, time is just freaking meaningless. Okay.
Yeah. I'm like that terrible episode of Quantum Leap where, you know, you go through all your bullshit and you realize, oh, no, wait, I was the dick. Oh. Sam never had to come to that conclusion. That's just me every other day of my life. Like, oh, yeah, no, all these things, devil's advocate, let's do this in the end. Oh, yeah, no, I was the dick. Yeah.
No, Sam's a dick.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. Oh.
Well, why do you think we get along so well? First off, gorgeous beards.
Yes.
Great, great cheekbones. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful bone structure.
Yeah.
Stunning eyes. Yeah. Mostly
stunning.
You, buddy.
Stunning. Absolutely.
So besides being preternaturally beautiful.
Yeah.
We understand that we're the dicks in the situation. We're willing to be the sin eaters. Yeah. We'll take that mantle because other people don't want it, and we can bear the load, friend.
That's right. This guy gets me. I love this.
No, we got to stick together.
You're my ride or die from now on.
I love it.
Okay, so what happens next? What then?
So that's the end of the case, really.
What?
And it never showed up again. We never got any closure, as in all of these cases. That's part of the beauty and the horror of it all. That'll be my third book on cryptozoology that I'll never probably write. The beauty and the horror, describing why it's awesome that we never will know and why it fucking sucks that we don't fucking know. But we live with that. We live with that every day in this field, and that's okay. So I will, if you don't mind me getting into like some theories that people had.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I would like to dip into this. And that is, some investigators have suggested that the monster was associated with a spate of UFO sightings, which is pretty exciting because not a lot of people broach this part, that allegedly plagued the region during the same period. Now, this is really hard to corroborate.
Okay.
I have not found a ton of information. What I have found is a little bit of information suggesting that it happened without a lot of accounts. So again, we take it with a grain of salt, but there is a chance that it happened. And if this thing could be one thing besides amphibious, and we all know that's my go-to, it's an alien.
Mm-hmm.
It is truly an alien biological life form, whether or not it is from Earth. And that's just indicative of its body type and anatomy and everything else. Okay. So that having been established, that some people suggest that there was in Illinois, in the Midwest in general, a bunch of UFO sightings, and that maybe this is associated. There are others who have asserted that this fucking thing, and I guess this is also understandable, with its tendencies to be aggressive toward humans, their homes, their sneakers, has all the earmarks of a classic demonic attack.
Ooh, all right.
And I, again, I'm going to plug shamelessly my podcast, Cryptonaut Podcast, which, you know, I do with Chris Carnicelli and Mark Storrs, and that is one of our catchphrases that has caught on inexplicably is hell or space. Mm-hmm. And it seems like if it's not waterborne, this thing could either be from hell or space, both wide open and both smell like sulfur. Okay. Apparently, I don't know. I'm not a fucking astronaut, so don't be a dick about it.
There was no reports of it smelling, though, right? That we know of?
Not this thing. No.
Okay.
Nope. Nobody. And you'd think if it was a bog creature, and that's got a little bit of a something. You're going to smell that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like Sam.
Hey. I got a natural musk.
Yeah. A sexy musk.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's skunk apes.
That's a Pacific Northwest fern musk. That's a manly northern musk, not the dirt swamp. I'm not shitting on swamp apes.
Well, the good news is you don't have to because they already smell like shit. So there you go.
But that's a funk.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah, Yankee Candle's not on that.
No, absolutely not.
They're not having that.
No.
That's not on their Christmas release list.
If you want to smell like a skunk ape, just go soak yourself in cat piss. Ugh.
So let me throw something at you guys, cat piss aside. Could we be dealing with something? And of course, it's already shit the bed because the time has elapsed since I wrote this. And that is, could this be like a cicada, something that works on a 30-year cycle? Something that digs down into the mire, the bog mud, if you will, hibernates, sleeps it off, gets their shit together, and comes out intermittently. Now, again, the 30-year time limit has elapsed, so I'm already like poo-pooing my own theory, but I mean, you got the 41-42 sightings, then you got the 73 spate, which may very likely is a different creature. And maybe it lasts a little longer, or maybe its territory had since been dug up for, you know, suburban renewal or whatever purposes, and they inadvertently killed the thing. I mean, you'd know, Sam, I don't know if you have any buddies that live this life, but are there things that, you know, work on decades-long cycles of hibernation and resurrection, breed, eat, die, and then the next gen moves on?
Look, I mean, I get what you're saying. It's not out of the question. It's not out of the question. But I think what you're talking about here, something that comes back on a 30-year cycle or whatever, you're talking basically about some sort of cryptid like cicada, okay?
True.
Which, by the way, we are currently here in the Midwest looking down the barrel of a cicada outbreak of biblical proportions. I mean, it is like a coming plague that is coming. But that's neither here nor there, guys. It's neither here nor there. The point is this, that maybe the fact of the matter is simply this, that even if this thing did come back now, maybe it already did, but who the hell would notice? Because people are too busy looking at their goddamn phones, you know?
That's true.
Get their heads buried in the phones. They're not going to notice any of this crap, and they're certainly not going outside to, you know, for walks and stuff where they might see stuff like this, you know?
Fair.
You know, that's number one. And number two is, well, maybe it did come back, but because of, you know, climate change, its environment has changed and it's no longer suitable to its survival. So this thing has moved on. It's like, maybe it's no longer like down there in, you know, like in Illinois, but maybe it's moved north. Maybe it's in like Wisconsin now, you know? You know, maybe that's what they're dealing with. Who the hell knows? I mean, Wisconsin's got enough weird shit. This thing would just fit right in. You know what I'm saying?
All valid points. I love it. I love it.
I'm just spitballing here, man. I'm just spitballing.
Mm-hmm. No, that's what we do. That's the deal. That's the life we've chosen, friends. We're not here. We can only recite so many facts. Yeah. At some point, it is all speculative academia. Yeah, I coined that phrase. You're welcome to use it. Uncle Rob, 2024. Yeah. Speculative academia is the heart of cryptozoology. So go.
Yeah.
Run free, my friends. Naked in a field. Talk your shit. I'm here to listen.
Yeah, I would say if you're looking for this thing at this point, I'd be looking somewhere in, I don't know, Wisconsin, maybe.
It's very close.
It's just trekking north. I don't know.
So when all is said and done, as I stated in the beginning of this, and that's why I was so glad you guys brought me on to talk about it. The Enfield creature is one of the most spectacularly brief and utterly original, undeniably harrowing accounts in the field of unknown animals, in the field of cryptozoology. It comes on quick. It is leaving a lasting impression on the eyewitnesses and anyone, clearly by us talking about it, that has ever read about it. And it's gone almost as soon as it started. We can't possibly know its origin. We can't, you know, there's just no way to ascertain what's going on. But to me, this is one of the great joys. There are the staples, the pillars of cryptozoology. Even though I fully believe in you, Sam, we've got the hairy hominids, we've got the Bigfoots and their ilk, we've got the lake monsters. The chupas are coming up hard. They're doing their thing until you throw in those garbage Texas chups, which, by the way, are hairless, blood-drinking dogs. Different name, hashtag, not my chupacabra, fuck those things. But you have pillars of cryptozoology, and then you've got these young upstarts, these punks, these rebels that just come in, rock hard, and split. And as a punk rock fan, I can say Enfield Horror represents to me one of the coolest, quickest, most memorable punk rock fucking blast that have ever happened. It showed up hard, it rocked your tits off, and then it evaporated. And that's what makes this case, among all the other elements, one of the classics to me.
Yep. Punk music. Like the Spin Doctors. God, I miss the 90s.
Spin Doctors weren't punk.
Just like the Spin Doctors. Yep.
I mean, I also would have accepted Op Ivy.
Oh, yes.
I would have accepted other things. But you know what? That's a fine reference. Spin Doctors were also music.
That was a thing, right?
And I will give you that. And I might sound patronizing. That's because I am. God damn it, dude. I said punk rock.
I don't know.
But Sam, you know what? I love you. And we have more in common than apart. So that having been said, it is one of the great moments in music. Let's just make it broad spectrum. Where this thing just showed up, fucking said, hey, your tits are gone. Sorry. Rocked them. Left. And we're still talking about it. Oh my God, half a century fucking later, over half a century later. And that to me is amazing. But it's eternally frustrating that it didn't have a resurgence, that, you know, we can't know more, that the eyewitnesses, those that are still alive, their memories are surely fading. A half a century does wonders to the fucking mind, not most of them good. But all of that aside, it's still incredible. And the thing is, you know, for a lot of people, it was one of those throwaway things. It was one of those side projects. It's like, this doesn't matter. This is this weird thing. And it couldn't be cryptozoologists of the time who were striving for legitimacy in the same way ufologists do, by only like gravitating towards the most mainstream, biggest, most repetitive, not that anything could be repeated in a lab, cases. They were like, oh yeah, this is just a throwaway weird thing. Let's focus on these returning creatures. And I get it. When you're trying to create a science, or a branch of science that deals with biology, zoology, other things, you have to go legit. I don't fault them for it, but it is these weird things that otherwise might have fallen through the cracks that to me are some of the most exciting places to visit when you're looking into cryptozoological escapades, because they are unique. They are biologically bizarre. And they make us think, like, you have to walk in with the assumption that this is not bullshit. This really happened. And if this really happened, that's where you challenge your mind to be like, okay, how could this be real? What could explain this? And in what circumstances would these poor people, especially children who are really left mortified, probably scarred by this, what is it that could have caused this to happen? And why did it end as abruptly as it began? And to me, I get you can't build a foundational science on it, but you can really explore very interesting dynamics, and not only how we relate to the greater studies of zoology and cryptozoology, but also the social and psychological studies of how these things affect the victims, for lack of a better word.
Rob, what do you personally think this thing was?
Again, I drop in my little and the wet hole of the amphibians. Please don't read into that. And I think the only thing that makes logical sense, if the gist of what the eyewitnesses are saying is accurate, and this is what's really going on, and there was a spate of UFO sightings at the time. I'm not saying I think it was, but I'm thinking the most reasonable thing to me is, not necessarily an extraterrestrial, but an alien intelligence, whether it be interdimensional, whether it be whatever, because there is nothing on Earth. I mean, there are plenty of creatures that we will never know about that went extinct. Most of them are gone. Most of them are weird. Most of them would delight and inform us and be like, oh, shit, we were wrong. Like Göbekli Tepe did to archaeology. Like, oh, shit, we got to push everything. But sorry, fucked up. That's science. But that's the beautiful thing about science, is that it can also evolve and learn. We don't know everything. But what we do know is three-legged fuckers don't exist in the biological record. And this thing is that. We know things with little T-Rex arms do it because we got a T-Rex, but fucking big red eyes, super hopping. I mean, is this thing a marsupial? Is it like a super possum from like that just had a divergent evolutionary path like 65 million, 88 million, whatever years ago? I don't know. But none of that makes sense to me because there is no paleontological legacy for something like this. So if it exists, it has to be either extraterrestrial, interdimensional, or something, whether it's the thinning of a veil or a UFO landing and, letting this dude go out for a walk and then he gets away off his leash and he fucks up some kid's sneakers and scares the fuck out of some other kids and then, freaks out people and Lauren Coleman goes, ooh, he sounded pretty. And then it just hops back on the UFO and goes home. If that's the case, I'm okay with that, wherever it came from. But that to me is the only really viable hypothesis, is that it is not from here. What that means, I don't know. Where from whence it came, who can say? But it does not seem to be part of the evolutionary processes of Earth as we know it. So I'm going with interdimensional ET, for lack of a better fucking phrase.
You don't know. Now, Sam, do you think this could have been a four-legged thing at one point? What do you think, Sam?
Like this thing lost a limb or something? Like, I don't know. Like, I've heard everything. Yeah. I've heard people say it was a kangaroo and that in the dark it looked like it had three legs. I've heard that. And that, like, maybe it got hit by a car and that's why it looked all fucked up. I don't know. I've heard stories like that. I've heard stories that, like, but the thing is, like Rob said, it's like things on Earth are symmetrical. Like, biological creatures on Earth are symmetrical for the most part, unless they're a mutant. Or unless they got a mutation of some sort, which could happen. But even so, if that's the case, then what the fuck was this thing mutated from? Because it still doesn't work. So, I mean, like you said, I don't know. I have no clue what the hell this could be. A kid in a costume, no, probably not. Because once the guns come out, they're not, the costume comes off at that moment. They're not going to dick around with that. So I don't know. I mean, again, I'm back to this thing. Like you said, extraterrestrial, maybe it's a interdimensional. I don't know. I have no clue because there isn't even another case of anything like this that I know of that has three legs. There isn't there's not like some case in China of something like this or over in Europe that I've never heard or seen this before. So I don't know. I mean, I can tell you this.
Please.
That when we have the cryptid prom at Creepy Acres, I've never seen this guy there.
Everything on Earth loves, and I'm sorry to have interrupted you there, bilateral symmetry. Everything loves bilateral symmetry. Nothing in the fossil record is indicative of like, hey, let's try seven. That shit never happens. And I'm not saying it wouldn't be cool, that it couldn't, mutations aside, of course. But this thing seems like, obviously, creatures of all kinds, human beings included, can overcome impediments, the loss of a limb, things like that. This seems truly grounded in what it is. It is very good at jumping way too far, like much further than even the most, you know, kangaroos say. Again, going back to that, the biggest leaping things we have don't seem to jump like this thing did, nor do they, you know, have talons, nor, I mean, again, a mutant, but the, like, the little tiny, like, torso arms. Like, how many things do we know that had that besides the T-Rex? Like, that thing just evolved to, like, be a running, toothy nightmare that didn't give a fuck about grabbing anymore because it didn't need to. Its mouth did all the work. I mean, is this thing that? I doubt it. I mean, but even if it is, the three fucking legs throw it for a loop. This thing, I will never say anything de facto because I love being wide open, but I'm really convinced that this is not from here.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever that is.
I would agree. I would totally agree. I mean, if this thing is real, I don't know what the hell this is. It's not from here.
Right.
Laura, what do you think?
Gosh, I don't know either. I mean, I'm trying to think of what animal that we know of that could jump that high and that even looks remotely similar. And I can't
think
of anything. No. I'm stumped.
That's the beauty of cryptozoology. Again, I know I've said that at least 11 times. Let me tell you, cryptozoology is beautiful and a lot of things are gorgeous about it. One of the beautiful things is you get stumped and that means you have to start thinking outside of the box. And that's where it gets exciting. Mm-hmm. And that, again, I know I've been redundant on this point, but I'm saying again, one of the aspects I love about the Enfield horror is that it makes you think outside of the box. It makes you challenge yourself. It makes you wonder how the fuck it could, period. Like, that's it. Like, not like you don't finish that sentence. Like, how the fuck could, and then you just pause at a question mark and move on. That's a delight. That's a challenge. Right. That's a joy. I wish more zoologists would take it up. The way physicists are embracing the UAP, formerly UFO phenomenon, and I'm delighted. And it's about goddamn time because it is fascinating and demands this sort of research. I wish, and I shouldn't even say that it doesn't happen because I've been in a privileged position to talk to a lot of people who I've been lucky enough to influence, and it astounds me to this day, but you do anything for 25 fucking years, you're bound to make a mark. And I have a lot of people that were kids when they first read my stuff on American Monsters, and then they went to college and they gave zero shits, and then they were into, like, partying and fucking ska and their girls. But then they came back and said, I still like cryptozoology. And, oh, wait, by the way, I got my doctorate in zoology. And I want to look into these things. And to these people, I say, kudos. I commend them. Do your work. Do your practical things. Make your living. Work in the zoos. Do whatever you got to do. But in your spare time, if you still want to, like, find out what could possibly make the Enfield horror and, oh, so many monsters like that tick, then I mean, I think that might be the greatest contribution I've ever personally made, is when I hear from people that whether they have doctorates or they're simply still curious. We're like, oh, I read this stuff when I was a kid and my mind is still open to it. That makes me so happy. And if I've done nothing else, when I, like, shuffle off this mortal coil, I'll be like, hot diggity damn, that was worth it. And that is one of the greatest beauty of cryptozoology, is that if you're willing to keep an open mind, then the world is this expansive, delightful enigma that is worth exploring, even if you never get the answers.
Well said.
My God, that is beautiful.
Oh, shucks.
This has been amazing. I'm so glad we finally got to, like, meet in person.
Oh, my God. We are old friends. People might not know. We are old school friends, and we can definitely harangue each other, and I delight in every bit of it.
You know, and I got to say, I was very excited to find out I was going to have a front row seat of you two finally speaking. Like, not necessarily in person, but for real.
I know.
No, after I mean,
forever. This is awesome.
Yeah, and it's been mostly, I mean, this is virtual technically, but it's been mostly through typing, texting and you know, direct messaging and other things and emails. So yeah, to have a real conversation, honestly, it's been way too long. It's sort of a dream come true. Thank you, Laura, for insisting this happen, because God knows I am a human. I'm the cryptozoological cicada. I will hide in the mud for many years and not do anything. And you made it happen. So yeah. And Sam, I'm so glad you could be here too, because Laura's the best.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, I love you. You are just, you are the good shit, quote unquote, period. And I'm so delighted you're a part of this enterprise, because this is an extraordinary, informative, entertaining, escapade that I delight in. It's not just, you know, a contemporary, but as a fan. You guys are doing wonderful things, and your pod is extraordinary, and your videos are also just brilliant and hilarious. It is wonderful. I know this isn't the Mutual Fluffer Society, but I just had to tell you, it is an honor to be a part of this. And I'm so delighted Laura, is a person as wonderful and talented and cool as you have always been, is now a part of this mechanism. It is fan-fucking-tastic, and I'm delighted now to close the circle, as it were.
We're shutting the whole thing down next week. I am so sorry.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Is it my fault? Fuck.
Well, this is all we wanted. We got here.
Right. You cheap.
We're done.
It's there. I'm the climactic moment. I'm so sad for everybody else.
All bullshit aside, Rob, I gotta say thank you so much for coming on here and taking the time to hype us up for all four of our fans. Yeah. I gotta say thank you. My mom's gonna be ecstatic. And then the other three. I mean, this is great.
Ha ha. Dude, multiple. Scores? No. Hundreds? No. Thousands? No. Tens of thousands. Let me go out there. Tens. Hundreds? Tens. Maybe. And soon, if not. Millions? Inevitably. Because honestly, what you guys do is the Crypto Lord's work. It is fucking funny and informative, and you cannot ask for anything more of anything you love. If you love something like unknown creatures and cryptozoology, this is a wonderful resource and a great and entertaining way to learn and be delighted and to have a hell of a ride along the way. You know, so I'm glad that we're all a part of this, but I'm really, really glad to be a part of what you guys are doing. It's an honor and a joy for me. So thank you.
Oh my God. I'm so choked up. Jesus Christ. Wow.
Where's my Kleenex?
Hey, you know what, buddy? From the bottom of my heart, ditto.
Yes. Nailed it. Yeah. Yep. That's perfect.
I can't say it better than that.
Well, I'd be delighted to accept said compliment. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Rob, where can people find you if they want to read all about these other cryptids or more on the Enfield Horror?
So here's a bunch of things that I'll throw out there. There's cryptopia.us. That is the website that I have not updated in a hellaciously long time, and I apologize, but a lot of the old articles are still there. And you can hear about all of these things because we did an episode. I should be able to cite the number. I cannot, but you could find it easily on our Cryptonaut podcast. So we explored it there as well. And that can be found on everything like Stitcher and I don't even know what Apple, anywhere you can find podcasts, including YouTube, including our own website, kryptonautpodcast.com. You can listen to it there. So anywhere you want to hear our shit, you can find it there. Cryptopia.us is another place. Random weird magazines and the Internet Archive for American Monsters, but most of that stuff has been translated up into Cryptopia. So these are the places that you can find the work. You can see me in The Devil's Academy, a Travel Channel documentary where I got to be a big bald bearded talking head talking about how the devil took over an entire high school and threw the kids asunder and terrorized the teachers, and it was wonderful. So that was fun. That's out there. But yeah, that's it. That's about it. So kryptonautpodcast.com and all the places you get podcasts is one of the best places to hear me and Mark Storrs and Chris Carnicelli break this shit down to the best of our limited abilities, and cryptopia.us. There it is.
I love it.
Mm. This is great. Yeah, this has been a lot of fun.
Tons of fun. Oh, a joy. Please.
Seriously, thank you. And we love you. And we want you back on the show.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, this was a fucking great time. You guys have another weird cryptid and you want me to talk about it? I'm awesome. It's awesome. Okay. I love doing it. And talking about it with, again, people that love it and care makes it all the sweeter. So, yes. Anytime, let's do it.
Perfect.
This is awesome. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Go enjoy the rest of your night.
You're welcome. Oh, fuck yeah. Oh, man, I've got so many stupid books I need to read, and I'm going to fucking eat in a fucking inappropriate amounts of sugary shit, and I'm just going to pass out. So thank you, guys. Good night and big love.
Love you.
Okay. Love thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, wait. Laura, before you say anything.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Before you say anything, I need to know. Now, you have been friends with Rob Morphy for years. You have been talking to him for years.
Years.
Online. You haven't actually spoken to him by phone, Zoom, anything like that.
Now, you finally got to meet him. And I need to know, did the man live up to the legend?
Absolutely not.
Oh, God.
Very disappointing guest.
Oh.
I'm kidding.
God. Oh.
I love him.
I was very worried there for a second. I was like, oh, Jesus, what have I done? Okay. All right.
Rob Morphy is like precious gem. I love him. I love him even more now.
All right. That I'll believe. All right. I was a little worried there for a second.
No. Oh, my God. No, I love him. He was great.
Okay.
No, seriously, if you guys have not listened to Rob and Mark and Chris on the Kryptonaut podcast, please go listen. They are amazing and funny and very informative. What are you doing?
Look, I'm going to be honest with you here right now. If anyone is currently listening to this podcast, my guess is they were listening to the Kryptonaut podcast long ago, and only now have stumbled upon this mess.
It's a hot mess.
Oh my God. Yeah, look, at this point, I'm pretty sure the only reason anyone's listening to this, I mean, besides your fantastic work, Laura, besides that,
the only other reason
they're listening to this currently is because they are getting their fix while they are waiting for the next episode of the Kryptonaut podcast to come out, and they had to hear Rob Morphy's voice. I think that's what's happening.
Yeah, he has a great voice.
He does. He does have a good voice. Mm-hmm. It's solid. Yeah, it's a damn good voice. Now,
yes,
I have a surprise for you.
Oh,
that's right. Okay.
Wow.
Look, you
is
may
it a
not
good
know.
Surprise?
This. Yes, it's a good surprise. This is a good surprise. Okay. You may not know this, but April this month is my birthday month. You may not know that.
I know.
Oh. Well,
Sam, you've kind of told me like a million times, and you've already given me like a birthday gift list of what you want.
I know, it's true. And I leave post-it notes everywhere, but I don't know if you read them because they just keep showing up in the trash. I don't know if you're reading them or not. But okay, the point is this.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. My point is this. I, as a birthday present to myself and as a gift to you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You're so generous.
I know. I booked my own guest.
Oh, God. Who is it?
Well, I am going to give you a hint. He's from across the pond.
Okay.
It's not Andy McGrath. I will tell you that. Andy, I change my profile pic every 6 seconds, McGrath. It's not him. I love that man. I love him.
I love him, too.
Yes. It's not him.
Is it Mr. Sam Sheeran again?
It is not Mr. Sam.
Although he is in L.A., but he's from England.
Yes, you are correct. But okay. It is not him either. And we do love him.
We do.
Love him. This is a new guest.
A brand new guest.
We've never spoken to him. Yes. A brand new guest we've never spoken to before.
Uh-huh.
Is that our guest is none other than...
Uh-huh. Yes.
Call ended.
Wow. Okay. Rejected again. You can find us at creepyacres.com, and you can listen to us wherever you get your podcasts, also YouTube, and we're on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, which is now called X, Threads, and we have merch at tpublic.com.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And as always, hey, keep it creepy.